This is an ABC podcast.
I can remember being in a supermarket in January this year when the first reports were trickling through of this dangerous, mysterious new coronavirus emerging from China. And I noticed that in the supermarket already there were people with their trolleys filled with things like two-minute noodle packets, pasta, frozen meals, paracetamol, and of course toilet paper. These were the people who were panic shopping before the real panic shopping began. And I noticed that they were whispering quietly to each other about how they were getting themselves ready if the nation had to go into lockdown. Then weeks later, the pandemic was upon us and Australians were suddenly glued to TV and radio news, longing for a bit of expert advice. Mary Louise McLaws is an epidemiologist and she's become a regular and often reassuring sight on our TV screens during the pandemic. For Mary Louise, this wasn't her first pandemic. It was her fourth. In the course of her career working in infectious disease control, Mary Louise has worked with people affected by HIV, SARS, avian flu, and now, of course, COVID-19. And she's also met with hundreds of health workers and hospital staff who put their own lives and the lives of their families at risk while they work on the front lines because the work was necessary. But now, 10 months in, there is some hope, a cautious hope, that we may have a vaccine far sooner than anyone could have predicted at the outset. And perhaps now we'll all be better prepared for the next ghastly virus that launches itself upon the world. Hi, Mary Louise.
Hi, Richard. Nice to be with you.
Now, Mary Louise, kids don't tend to say, oh, I want to be an epidemiologist when I'm growing up. Or do they? Was that you as a kid, Mary Louise?
No, I actually wanted to be an astronaut or either in the Air Force flying a fighter jet. So I'm a failed astronaut.
How tragic. What changed your mind?
Well, I started life with a single mother. There were three of us. And my mother met my stepfather and he was in the Air Force. He was a wonderful man. And he and I used to talk about flying all the time. So I think that I became like a co-pilot for my stepfather, just playing, let's pretend I'm in an aeroplane.
I think I'm in the same boat as you. I wanted to be an astronaut, but not only did I not get the marks, I'm afraid, I just realised I don't think I could cope too well with the zero gravity in the instrumentation panels, I'm afraid, Mary Louise. Was that you as well?
No, I quite like the idea. I mean, I actually, for relaxation, watch anything about space or, you know, sci-fi. I have a slight adventurous tendency, but not physically, more intellectually adventurous. But I figured that I was born too soon to get into the Air Force to fly an aeroplane. And in those days, you had to have a license, you know, to fly an aeroplane to then go into the training for being an astronaut. And I looked into this and thought, this is going to cost a lot of money. So sadly, no, I never became a pilot or an astronaut.
Now, you mentioned your mum was a single mum before she met your stepfather. What kind of an influence was your mum on your life?
So my mother was really before her time. She was quite remarkable. So my mother kept saying, education is really important. People can't take your education away from you. You can always stack shelves, you know, if you need be, but you do need an education. And she used to come home from philosophy groups, so they would have afternoon tea and talk about philosophy. And I remember her coming home saying, well, we've just had this discussion about needing to keep fit because we're all going to be wearing stretch gear. Now, this was when I was a young teenager, and I'm sitting here talking to you in my stretch gear. And
so you're the epidemiologist, but it was your mum that predicted we'd all be wearing activewear during the actual
she did.
Crisis.
She did. So, yeah, she was a remarkable woman. She would dye her hair auburn and wear outrageous colours. So,
wow.
Oh, yes.
Wow. So she was really quite flamboyant and conducting philosophy classes at the end of it. That's amazing. She sounds like quite an inspirational figure then.
Yes. And liked to feed everybody. So she had a fridge and two freezers in case I might want to invite the class home to do some study.
So when you came out of uni, that was the 1980s, and that was when we were just sort of getting into the AIDS crisis, the HIV crisis. What kind of work were you drawn into during the HIV crisis?
So it was happening around me in the mid 80s, and I was doing a degree looking at issues with infection relating to surgery. And I shared my office at the university with a young researcher from the AIDS research unit. One day he said he's going to introduce me to his boss, the late Professor David Cooper, an amazing man. And so he's asking me these questions like, what would you do if you had, or you know, anything you wanted to do in HIV? So I gave him all these crazy ideas. And at the end, he said, would you want to come and work for me? And I said, well, I was thinking of doing a doctorate. And he said, do it with me. And I thought, this man's amazing. I can't say no. And it was a really intellectually fascinating but emotionally draining disease. And I thought, this is an offer of a lifetime that will never come again. So he required of me to come up with any madcap big idea. And the thing I loved about him was he'd never say no. He'd go, all right, how can we get this to work?
People who are 30 or younger, they, of course, have no memory of that time. But I remember it being a terrible time. There were all these people dying from it before they came up with the cocktail of therapies to treat it. What do you remember of that period?
Some days you'd go to a funeral of people that you worked with or the friends of people that you worked with. So where I worked was in a building in Albion Street with the testing clinic downstairs, and we were doing the research upstairs. And, you know, you could go to a funeral every week. So it was emotionally exhausting, and you wondered when you'd ever see it turning to at least gain some ground. It was a very emotional time, but all the scientists got together and really worked very hard. It's a bit like today. The amount of knowledge that you gained in 1 week was constantly on the increase because there were more and more research being published rapidly so that we could all get upskilled to work out where we were going next.
It was said at the time and afterwards that Australia's response was the gold standard in responding to the outbreak of HIV in the community. Why was that?
Well, we had people like the amazing David Cooper and Ron Penny. So we had visionaries. And of course, Australia, we give ourselves a lot of grief about being racist or not being open-minded. And certainly HIV challenged that. And I think that we rose to the challenge and improved ourselves. Many will say it took too long for same-sex couples to get equal legal rights, but eventually we did. So there were many, many voices of equality, fairness and justice. So it piggybacked onto that. And I'm hoping that with COVID-19, that people piggyback onto this for what are we going to do in the future when this happens again and people are underemployed? How are we going to ensure that they have less risk of the next pandemic, because it's always those who are underemployed and low socioeconomic level that always suffer.
And in 2003, there was the SARS outbreak in China and Hong Kong. Tell me how you were drawn into research into that.
Well, just before then, there, of course, was the avian flu, and I got a phone call from WHO asking me to go to China. And I was just about to leave when my husband, otherwise known as the pool boy, decided
to... Why do you call him the pool boy?
Because he's retired and he looks after the pool, but he's not the pool man because he can't be trusted with the chemicals, even though he has a PhD in chemistry, because he's a bit of a bucket chemist. You know, if he sees a fly, he tries to kill it, you know, with the whole contents of the can.
Right.
So he's not allowed to do pool man things. He's only allowed to do pool boy things with the pool. So the pool boy decided he'd have a heart attack. And and I think he was trying to do, it's my turn, look at me. So I had to ring up WHO and say, look, I'm really sorry. I've got my own little crisis going on here. Fortunately, poor boy pulled through with an excellent stent program at Royal North Shore Hospital. But then SARS came along, and by that time I had been working with many people from the hospital authority in Hong Kong, and I was asked to help identify how healthcare workers acquired or acquiring SARS. So I was very fortunate to learn an awful lot from Dr. Chu. She was very remarkable. So at the beginning of COVID-19, I had mentioned several times in the public, we need to be mindful of our mental health for our healthcare workers and the community. And that just floated off into the distance as if this isn't going to be a problem. But I had actually seen how Lily had ensured that her staff had things like meditation, counselling, because many of them didn't want to leave the hospital for fear of taking SARS home.
Well, does that mean that people were working around the clock and living, sleeping around the clock in the hospital?
Yes.
during the SARS outbreak?
Yes.
And was that because they didn't want to bring the disease home to their family?
Yes, oh, absolutely. Man. And also, of course, they were starting to see some of their own team members acquire SARS. They sadly rushed in to save patients and intubated them and, of course, put their face too close to their patients and breathed in a lung full of SARS. And then, of course, they quickly learn, a bit like when you're at in an aeroplane where they say, put your mask on first. Oh. They soon learn to care for themselves first before they started doing anything for their patients.
Because then they can't do anything for their patients once they get sick or even
worse. Exactly, yes. Exactly. And once they get sick, it put an enormous pressure on the rest of the team because they were a very, very tight team. And if anybody got sick, it was a terrible emotional toll on them.
So what were they like when you were speaking to them then about this situation?
In tears. So I had a number of them stand up, talk to me about their experience, and then burst into tears, one after the other after the other. And, of course, I realised that they were all suffering from PTSD. So we can't underestimate the pressure that healthcare workers at the front line are under. They really do need to have counselling so that they can debrief and move on and go home, and particularly not at the end of the pandemic, but all the way through the pandemic. And I think that we need to give all honour to Hong Kong and China, Vietnam, but mostly Hong Kong and China, where they had the majority of cases, because they didn't have the world behind them trying to help with a vaccine, except for that happened a little later, or developing therapies, either prophylactically. And I think had SARS become more widespread and the Western nations were affected, they may well have had more support. So I feel a little saddened for them that they did an awful lot of work themselves, but my goodness, they were just amazing during that time.
Now, SARS, as you say, was pretty much like a dress rehearsal for the COVID-19 crisis. SARS was a coronavirus like COVID, is that right?
That's right. It's apparently 80% genetically similar. However, there are so many things that are dissimilar to COVID-19. So at first we thought, oh, great, this virus doesn't like hot weather and doesn't like high humidity. So a famous virologist in Hong Kong did some laboratory tests to identify that SARS-CoV-1, that caused SARS outbreak, didn't like being heated at about 28 degrees C and at about 80% relative humidity. So the log survival dropped off dramatically when it reached at that level. So we were all thinking, well, maybe that explains why it disappeared very quickly. June just disappeared. However, I think what has come to pass is that this one doesn't seem to want to play by that game. I mean, we're seeing it not doing exactly that in hot climates as well. I mean, you've got India, that has high temperature, high humidity. You've got lots of other places in summertime in Europe, and it's not playing the game the way we were hoping it would. And the another answer is possibly that what we've learnt in April was that this COVID 19 disease has a much shorter, what we call, serial interval.
What is that?
That is where a person becomes exposed to the disease, and during that after being exposed, on about day three from exposure, day three, four, and five, they become infectious to others, so very rapidly, before they've even developed symptoms. And that's unlike SARS during 2003. It would appear as if they were really infectious only when they had symptoms, and they became very symptomatic very quickly. Where this one, oh yes, you know, on average, the incubation period. An incubation period means time it takes you from being infected to developing symptoms is about 6 days, 6.5 days. However, it also has an extra weapon up its sleeve, and that is it becomes infectious before you know that you're a danger to others. And that's probably why it seems to be so hard to stop the spread. And yes, it may quite like humidity, and it might be quite moisture-loving. So there are many things we still don't know. And when I attended the first roadmap meeting in Geneva in February, when 400 scientists turned up and kind of, you know, I'll show you mine if you show me yours, what do you know, what do I know, and we developed a roadmap of what we need to know very rapidly. There are many things we didn't know. And then the next roadmap meeting we had, Zoom, in July, there were still so many things we didn't know, but so many things that the world scientists have learned already. But we still don't know a lot about why SARS-CoV-1 disappeared so much more rapidly. So mine is only a hypothesis that it probably has something to do with its inability to be dissuaded to survive in warm temperatures and warm and high humidity, and also that very rapid serial interval.
I just want to ask a really basic, perhaps a slightly stupid question. What is a coronavirus?
It's a non-envelope virus, which basically means it is an RNA that can really easily be destroyed by simple things like soap and water.
You mean its genetic material can be easily destroyed?
Yeah, it's just destroyed because it doesn't have a coating around it that is very solid.
But that makes it sound like something that's easily gotten rid of then, fragile. Mm. Oh. Why is it so virulent if it's so fragile, if it's walking around in the nude all the time like this, as you say?
Yeah, because it's a psychopath. It's worked out that it's fragile. So what better than to hook into a human being and know that particular human beings have foibles for behavior. They like to be with other human beings. They like to hug and get close.
So are you saying essentially that because it's so vulnerable, that's why it's so ruthless?
If we were going to give it a personality, absolutely. It's worked out because it's vulnerable to simple things like being dried out by the sun and the wind, being killed by soap and water, being killed by alcohol-based hand rub gels. It needs to then protect itself. And how better than to spread, than get into a human being that will help its journey on the way? And that's why we've got to be very, very mindful that we don't do what this virus needs us to do to spread it.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm just remembering when I learnt the science of that. Like, I had saw Norman Swan explaining that you can destroy its genetic material just simply with soap. It just breaks it apart. And I do remember having this feeling, washing my hands, going, yeah, cop that. COVID-19. It felt like sort of revenge on some awful villain or something, which is a rather silly way of thinking about it, I know, but that's what I felt at the time.
No, I think it's great because give it a personality and then you'll feel inclined to want to get rid of it out of our lives.
Well, as you're telling me this, I'm a big John le Carré fan, and he's, you know, his great research assistant who had a streak of genius in it, her name was Connie in the books. When a new Russian spy would appear at the Soviet embassy in London, she'd go, "Oh, hello, I'm going to have an interesting time with you." Do you think like that when a new virus comes along the scene? Do you go, "Hello, what are you like? What are your characteristics? What's your history?"
Absolutely, you
think of them having a kind of a personality in a funny sort of way.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And so when COVID came along, learning about this virus that's so weak, what makes this virus such an I don't know.
A psychopath, I think you said earlier, didn't you?
A psychopath, yes, exactly. Mm. I mean, what makes this enemy so incredible? And then I realized, in fact, it's us. We are its soldiers. And that's, of course, part of my interest is, you know, looking at patterns of how the epidemiology in Victoria is going and in New South Wales, because we have most of the cases, and then look at what feeds this pattern.
Well, let me ask you another question about what a virus is. Is it a living thing? Does it wriggle? How does science see it now?
Well, from an infection prevention and control perspective, if it's alive and viable, then we want to kill it.
Right.
We want to get rid of it.
So that's not really... But whether it's alive doesn't really matter then, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, some will say that it has to, of course, it needs a host to reproduce. And
so it's like a parasite then?
Yes, it needs to get into our cells to then reproduce. And it won't reproduce just sitting on a hard surface. However, from an infection prevention and control perspective, which is the other part of my work, is that if we know that it's going to be on a hard surface, for example, or in the air, and you can breathe it in, we want to kill it and get rid of it.
Mary Louise, where were you when you became aware that there was this new virus coming out of China and it might be a bit of an interesting problem?
I was sitting on the couch I'm sitting on right now, looking and hearing from my colleagues from WHO. And then I received a letter in the beginning of February wanting me to go to Geneva and have a meeting called the Roadmap to End COVID. They hadn't given it a name. And then actually during the meeting, they renamed the baby COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2.
When the World Health Organization calls such a meeting, is that done in secret so as not to alarm people, or is it done in complete openness?
It's normally done in complete openness, but we have to sign confidentiality forms so that anything that's said behind closed doors can be said with confidence around all sorts of government issues. But I made sure I had my university approval to travel, so they knew where I was going. And I wasn't told to keep it secret. I was just told to ensure that I didn't divulge any private conversations. So, yes, it was open. And don't forget, in January, WHO had already called a meeting of expert committee that decides whether or not we have what's called a public health emergency of international concern. And this particular committee is made up of representatives of the UN members, and they met 3 times before they decided to call it a public health emergency of international concern.
So that's a thing. That's a FEIC, is it? That's an acronym for public health emergency of international concern.
And that is far more important than calling a pandemic.
Why?
So when you call a FEIC, all the UN members are legally required to start responding and preparing for the pandemic. So our government would have known that we were going to go into a serious issue on the 30th of January. So when they called the FEIC on the 30th of January, now when they called it a pandemic, This is when the public thinks that this is when you act, and that's not the case. A pandemic is called, basically, it means that the outbreak has now gone out of one World Health Organization region to a second one. And it's an administrative call. The real call is the FEIC, and that was on the 30th of January. Now, when our Prime Minister called a pandemic early, just before WHO called for it, what he was doing was getting the public aware to expect things to change, because he had heard and he knew that a FEIC had been called, and quite rightly, he was responding accordingly, telling the community that we're in for a rough ride and we need to start planning and preparing ourselves.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
I suppose your experience with all this meant that once you were aware of the FEIC, the public health warning, you more than, I'd say about 99% of Australians at the time going back from Geneva would have been aware what was coming, the magnitude of what was coming.
Yeah, so, attending that meeting was quite an honour. And we had, of course, Dr. Tedros was there chairing the large meeting, and then we broke up into nine themes. And during the large meeting, we had experts in China patching in electronically, telling us what was happening epidemiologically and clinically. And of course, then we had expert virologists, anthropologists. We had virologists explaining what they knew, what they didn't know. And then we were asked to go into our specialty groups to decide on a roadmap for what are the research priorities. I was first sent into epidemiology, and that was a great honour because I was with some of the really leading epidemiologists of outbreaks from Hong Kong, for example, and they shared their experience, and people from the Middle East who'd had experience with MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. And they shared exactly what was happening, what we needed to know epidemiologically. And then the next day I was asked to go to the infection control group to kind of seed between the two groups what we knew but what we also didn't know. And then we then came together with Dr. Tedros, who then got each of the groups to present to everybody else where we needed to focus our energies. And, of course, Dr. Tedros was engaged with donors, and Bill and Belinda Gates were already donating, and he could see the Director General could see that this was going to be a lot of money. This was going to be very expensive. So there were a lot of NGOs, non-government organisations, wanting to know how this was going to impact their role as well.
It still seems, I don't know if I'd call it a baffling disease, but we're still in early days, aren't we? There's still so much we don't know about its long-term effects, but the picture is getting clearer all the time. What other parts of the body does it seem to have long-term effects upon, other in the strongest cases, other than the lungs?
Yeah, so before I get to that, I just remind you that we also don't know what the infectious dose is either. So there are some really simple things that we have known about other diseases, but we don't know yet. So what you're talking about is very important, and it's what Australia needs to focus on, and that is how to prevent this virus from entering important organ tissues and causing long-term comorbidities or morbidities, illnesses, chronic disease. And what we didn't talk about in Geneva and what has surfaced later was, of course, because we hadn't seen enough people acquire COVID and then survive, are the young and very fit who survive it, are often go under the radar because they haven't been hospitalized, and then suffer these terrible long-term effects that are respiratory, so cardiovascular, brain fog, fatigue, because it's a disease of inflammation. And we know that a lot of viruses cause post-viral fatigue. And I don't know if you recall, a number of years ago, people were talking about chronic fatigue syndrome. And since this virus has come to everybody's attention, I get a lot of emails from people talking about how they've had different types of viruses, but that they have this terrible fatigue. And could I look into this? Because is it similar to COVID-19? And the answer is yes, it's viral and it's similar. It may well have a similar organic source to it. So we're learning a lot about why and how it causes disease, and why the elderly are so at risk. And often the elderly with cardiovascular disease are at risk because their age, and given their age, your body starts to not function as well. And so they may have, you know, underlying kidney disease, liver, other lung issues, hypertension, and all of this prevents them from being able to produce a really good response, and they don't seem to have what's called cardiac reserve, and so they get very ill.
It seems to me that the calls you hear sometimes from people who are saying, look, it's just bad flu, and you'll get over it, in most cases, unless you're very old or you've got some pre-existing comorbidities. I don't know, is that irresponsible insofar as it seems to ignore these longer-term effects that are becoming increasingly apparent?
Well, I think it's disrespectful, and that's why I don't use the term mild. I use the term non-hospitalized because, sure, our health authorities go out to visit people when they've been diagnosed to ensure that they don't need any more medical help than, you know, they are getting at home. But they often don't go on to what we would do is for other type of diseases or vaccinations, and that would be a surveillance system. So what would be really helpful is if we set up a surveillance system of everybody that's had COVID and identify how long it really took them to get better. So,
well, sorry, we don't have that already? I just assume we'd have something like that in place already.
Sorry, we have a surveillance system, but we aren't following them for long-term effects unless it's for some research with some small number of patients that are enrolled.
When you say we, do you mean like Australia, or do you mean
globally?
Really?
Yep.
That just seems mad to me. I mean, it seems to me this is massively relevant when it comes to the health of the human race here.
Well, there are studies being done, and they're often done in hospitals. And because hospitals, you're a captive patient, basically, and so you can be enrolled really easily into studies looking at therapies and how long it took you to get better, doing some antibody testing. But when you're at home, it's more difficult to follow you. So overseas there and in Australia, there now are starting to be some studies being done, particularly looking at monoclonal antibody therapies as preventive strategies, so that when you're sharing a house with somebody with COVID, you've had about 3 days of exposure. They then enroll you into a randomized control trial to see if they can prevent you from getting COVID while you're sharing a house. But getting back to mild or non-hospitalized COVID, as I like to call it, we need a register so that we can see what the prevalence is for long COVID. And that's that term that encompasses the fatigue, the respiratory, the cardiovascular serious ill effects. So you might not be able to walk to the shops, let alone get out of bed some days because you're breathless. And it's as if the virus, you know, of course, gets into the part of the brain that regulates your breathing, regulates your heart, and does that, and it doesn't go away. We don't know how long you will stay within that clinical spectrum. And we're hoping that it won't be forever. But this is where we need people to not get sick, so they never have to worry about, are they going to get long COVID, and also why we need a vaccine, so that we can vaccinate our young, particularly our young, so that they never have to go into middle age with chronic fatigue or any other ill health, let alone have to deal with, you know, the economy, which will not improve for quite some time, climate impact, etc. So we need to protect them so that they can then lead us into the next, you know, generations of Australians and humans.
Well, now that brings us to several issues which you've raised there, which is the light at the end of the tunnel sort of area of the conversation. I recently read a report in the New York Times from the science writer there who said, who's been doing a lot of research on the vaccine development. He said that at the outset of COVID, he was quite pessimistic. He observed, as many people did, that the quickest anyone's ever been able to come up with a vaccine is 4 years, and that was for the mumps, so we might be in for a long wait. But more recently, he says now that he's feeling much more optimistic, and the reason is, he says, there are 8 candidates for a vaccine, 3 of which are looking quite promising, and if that's the case, there ought to be some kind of, in the United States in any case, some program of mass immunization underway midway through next year. What do you think about that? Does that sound, I know this is all pie in the sky, but are you more optimistic perhaps now than you were at the outset, at the prospect of an imminent vaccine, Mary Louise?
Well, on February 11, when I was sitting in the World Health Organization with a really lovely virologist, I turned to her as a virologist, because I'm just an epidemiologist, and said, is it just me, or are you thinking 18 months as well? And she was kind of nodding, going, yes, it's going to be longer than everybody wants. And so that was February. And so if you're talking mid next year, that's still very optimistic. So you've got candidate vaccines that are doing very well, 2, 3 particularly that are doing very well, but often they fail in phase 3, 80% may fail in phase 3, and not all of them that pass get FDA approval in America, for example, and approval here. But this is extraordinary circumstances, and the outcome of success may be lower than what would have been for mumps or, you know, rotavirus and some of the other flu mist, some of the other vaccines that had an expected high level of success where their participants in the randomized control trials elicited long-lasting antibodies for more than a few months, but, you know, for either a whole season or longer, for flu or lifetime, or at least 5 years. In this particular instance, we're so desperate, given that it's global, that we might expect or accept a success rate of 60%, for example.
So we're not in a kind of situation where we're sort of looking for a kind of a silver bullet here to knock it out. It's more like HIV, where we're in a kind of a great big dirty fight and a guerrilla war where we're going to clutch together something as best we can, and we'll have perhaps an imperfect, initially anyway, outcome, but that's all, that's what's required under the circumstances.
So I'll remind you of Jonas Salk, who developed the polio vaccine. So he rushed it to market, and sadly, I think it was 100 children died and 200 got polio, and rushed it to market because 53,000 children in the Midwest in America were suffering from polio, and then went back to the table, and that's where phase 3 trials were developed. And then he didn't have a patent on it, which was just wonderful, and allowed Sabin then to improve on it. So what we may find is that the pharmaceutical companies, they've all signed an agreement, and they've given this undertaking to the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Companies to not cut any corners. So they have all agreed. But what I think we will find is that maybe the first one or two may only elicit neutralizing antibodies in 60 or 70%, if we're lucky, of the participants. And that may be seen as good enough that we then start vaccinating frontline workers and potentially the vulnerable. But if we can reduce the morbidity and the mortality, then that's a good thing.
You mentioned something earlier there. You mentioned a thing called monoclonal antibodies. What are they?
So monoclonal antibodies are antibodies that have been developed from harvesting some antibodies that human patients have elicited after being exposed to COVID-19. And then they put them into, one company has put them into a hamster to then harvest the antibodies of the same clone to then get very large numbers so that they can produce very large numbers of the same antibody to then use for either prophylaxis. So some companies are trialing it as prophylaxis to see if people don't get COVID, if, for example, they're healthcare workers or they're caring for people with COVID at home, or for treatment for people who have high viral load but haven't been able to elicit an antibody response themselves.
So these are essentially then, these are antibodies taken from people who have ideally COVID resistance within their systems, and you take those antibodies out and you clone them, you mass clone them to offer like a protective sheath, if you like, around the immune systems of people who what might be around someone with, for example, with you might be around someone who has COVID.
Yeah, so what it does is it kickstarts your immune system. So it, instead of waiting for you to get sick to develop the antibodies, it gives them to you.
So since we can make those, why aren't we all getting them right now? Why aren't they being? It's a really naive question, I know, but why aren't they being mass produced and handed out at the supermarket right now, or at the doctors or the chemists?
Very good question. So two companies that are developing this are finding the same thing. But what they don't know yet is, because they've only done it on a couple of hundred people, not thousands yet. And the other thing they don't know yet is, does it work better when you give a low dose or a high dose? So there are many things they still aren't sure about.
If we had a United States which was engaged, as previous administrations were, in the Ebola outbreak, that was ready to lead like a moonshot program, if you like, a massive coordinated international undertaking early in the game to contain the disease and find a vaccine for it, do you think we'd be in a much better place than we are in right now, Mary Louise?
America has always been a go-to place for the most amazing innovation and science. As an epidemiologist, I've been to the Center for Disease Control. It's Mecca for epidemiologists. They are an amazing nation full of the most exquisite scientists, and they've been hamstrung.
It seems to be much harder to make world health programs work when there's a vacuum like that, that the United States, where there's an absence of leadership that's normally provided by the United States. Perhaps that's a lesson we all have to learn from this time around.
Well, what I find surprising, Richard, is that America has the highest number. Now, they don't have the highest number of cases per million, nor do they have the highest number of deaths per million, but just by number they do. And the country that is above them for some of these leaderboard levels is Brazil and other countries, Iran. I mean, there are countries that are poor and disorganized when it comes to a solid surveillance, pharmaceutical, medical group. And yet, here's America that can usually solve very big problems.
Given that we now have seen COVID, do you think this is certainly not going to be the first pandemic that comes our way or the virus that wants to be a pandemic? Do you think hopefully Australia and other countries like Australia will be better prepared next time, ready and better able to contain it if we get another pandemic?
The countries that were the rapid responders were the countries that had experienced SARS and MERS, and pandemic influenza. Those countries had seen the devastation of two previous or sometimes three previous pandemics, and they knew what to do. And some of those countries had been criticised for, you know, the draconian approach of public health measures, but we now too have done our own lockdowns and realised that that is sadly one element in our armoury of public health that sometimes you need as a breaker. For the authorities to be able to do more tracking and tracing and put in place other requirements. So America was incredibly slow to respond. And I think if they had have had a different leader, the whole world would be in a different position right now.
Just finally, as it is often said that this will not be the first pandemic that comes our way. You know, if anyone who reads a bit of history knows that history is full of such pandemics. This is a thing that's happened again and again, and often in the past, people have had much less science with which to combat it. I wonder if the period we've been through in the last 50 years or so has been this kind of strange little reprieve, and even though what feels now like a weird situation, maybe it's more like back to normal as far as the world goes. What do you think?
Well, I think it's because we live in our only our Western bubble, because of certainly our neighbours in the Western Asia Pacific region would tell you that in fact they've had Zika, they've had SARS, they've had MERS, they've had flus. Hong Kong had to slaughter birds on a regular basis every week in the wet markets. So they have had this, and they still have it. On and off, and we just have not been engaged in it. And what I would like to see is a much closer relationship between us and our neighbours in the what we call Western Regional Office for that Asia Pacific region, where we set up a bubble of knowledge, help, tourism, and trade, so that when the next pandemic comes, we can at least open up to countries that have very similar approaches to trying to protect their nationals. And those countries at the moment are, China, maybe Japan. They need to do some more testing, though, because without a high level of testing, you don't know what you're dealing with. Vietnam, those sort of places, Korea, because when you travel there, you know you're going into a very similar epidemiological pattern. But I'll just take you back for a moment. Richard, when I work in Turkey, I love going into Istanbul, and of course there are these beautiful mosques, and on one of these mosques is a ceramic picture of Justinian, and I tell my students about what used to be called the Justinian plague.
Worst thing in the world that was terrible.
Yes. So there is, and there have been plagues, there always will be, and the World Health Organization put out a publication mid last year, and it was written by an independent group that said we will be suffering a pandemic very soon. So they were trying to tell the community, get together with your neighbours and become more dependent and helping each other. And recently the World Health Organization asked me to futurize what health service would be like in the Western Pacific region. And it was probably one of the most difficult projects that I've ever worked on, trying to visualize what we will be like in 30 years' time. And I kept thinking to myself, if climate change accelerates and we have a pandemic, that pandemic will look as if it's on steroids. So we had better prepare and prepare with our neighbours as well.
Do you mean by that climate change comes more forest fires, more wildlife fleeing into populated areas? Is that why you think that's an issue when it comes to pandemics?
Absolutely. all of those issues, absolutely. Then people fleeing from countries where they can't grow their food, the sea rising, they will come with potential diseases. And the closer we get to nature, if we're not respectful, the more we are challenged with these novel viruses. And of course, malaria as well, and lots of other diseases that we haven't had to deal with because our environment and our temperature doesn't assist them to survive and grow.
What examples have you seen of the better side of humanity coming out in this pandemic?
I think we're learning to slow down. I love having meetings with people where you can hear the gardening noise at the out and the kids shouting, or somebody's dog barking because it's time to be taken for a walk, that they're still on their game, they're still really clever and they're still answering questions, but life's still going on. We're not being put into a bubble away from everyday life. I think that's lovely. I think it's great that people ask how you're going. The other day I was giving an interview and I'd worked till about 1 or 2 in the morning for WHO and I had my morning voice on and I was asked, are you okay? And I thought, that is really, really sweet. People are showing kindness and tolerance where we're not as busy as we were. And I think that's really a good thing. But I'd like to see more having engagement with our regional friends and experts. I have friends who are great experts in other pandemics, and they've never been called upon or had a phone call from Australia saying, how did you manage to, you know, squash a second wave? We can learn from our colleagues overseas. They've got a wealth of knowledge. So I'd like to see more reciprocity going on.
Viruses are the great bringers of humility to great and powerful things. Mm. It's been fascinating speaking with you, Mary Louise. And even though you're down the line, let me give you a virtual elbow bump of gratitude.
Bump, bump.
Thank you so much, Mary Louise.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.